Laying in a hospital bed for days on end can wreak havoc on the body. We all know that immobility increases the risk of pneumonia, pressure injuries, and blood clots, but few really understand the deeper physiological impacts. In this episode, I explore these lesser-known effects with Margaret Arnold, a physical therapist with extensive experience working with nurses in the acute care setting. Together, we go beyond the obvious risks of immobility to uncover what's happening to the whole body of our bed-bound patients. Margaret provides eye-opening details about the rapid and honestly devastating consequences of physical inactivity. Since recording our discussion, I can honestly say that the way I have promoted mobility and conveyed its vital importance to my patients has drastically changed. So listen in as Margaret and I cover the true dangers of immobilization with some practical tips to inject mobility into your busy shift. You'll come away with a deeper grasp of this critical yet often overlooked issue with fresh motivation to get your patients moving. By the end of the episode, you may be just as surprised as I was about the surprising physiology of immobility and have some extra tricks up your sleeve for getting your patients up and moving.
Welcome to the Up My Nursing Game podcast. My name is Annie. I've been a clinical nurse for 8 years, and I am curious. I use this podcast to address common clinical questions, share unique perspectives across the healthcare team, and cover what's missed in nursing school. Are you studying for the CCRN or the PCCN? These are tough exams. I know, as I recently studied for the PCCN myself. I was luckily able to pass the exam by studying with Nicole Kupchick's online self-paced review courses, as well as her book of practice questions. I can't recommend these resources enough, and if you want to up your nursing career, check out her website, NicoleKupchickConsulting.com, and use the promo code UPMYGAME20 to get 20% off all of her products.
Hi, my name is Margaret Arnold. I am a physical therapist by training, originally from Scotland, but now live in Michigan. I worked all over the hospital, and what I'm passionate about is helping patients to navigate that continuum with the fewest number of preventable comorbidities and hospital-acquired deconditioning and sequelae of deconditioning as possible. Whether that is in the emergency room, in the ICU, acute care, subacute setting, or in the home care setting.
Margaret is the CEO of EarlyMobility.com, which is a consulting company that helps facilities implement early and safe patient mobility.
We understand that patients don't live in one shift. They don't live in one care setting. The care spans for them from home to the emergency room, if they're admitted, via an operation on the way, through PACU, through the acute care side. Sometimes they're into the post-acute care side if they're not ready to go home, and then all the way into the home care. And it's a circle for many of them.
Yeah, I love that. And I love how you talked about that. You know, one of the main pillars I have for this podcast is to be able to share those perspectives, because, you know, as nurses, we're often so stuck in the weeds of direct patient care on our department that we don't really get a chance to see what's happening to our patients before they get to us and what happens to our patients when they leave us. I think you bring in a great perspective that is very fitting for this podcast.
Everybody's busy, right? And everybody's short-staffed, and we're just tasked with sometimes just getting through our day. Sometimes it's hard for us to see what other disciplines are doing and the relevance, because we're so tied up in just the things we have to get done in a day. And sometimes the patient can inadvertently slip through the cracks with our current model of care because of so many of the challenges.
What departments did you work in?
I worked for 20 years in a hospital here in Michigan, and a lot of outpatient therapy. I worked with a lot of the nurses who had hurt their backs and shoulders and necks. And I was the occupational medicine physical therapist treating a lot of those problems. That's actually how I got into the safe patient handling journey, to say, what can we do to make things easier and less painful? For our nurses and our therapists got injured too, but not to the same degree as the nursing staff. So in that journey, I did a lot more work in the acute care side of the hospital. So really, I've worked in all areas. I've worked a lot in acute rehab. I've done a little bit in long-term care. Most of my work, certainly in the last 15 years, I still do a little bit of bedside PT because I can't quite give that piece up.
Mm-hmm.
What I've learned is there's ways for us to do this, to mobilize patients in a way that's safe, in a way that actually improves the patient outcomes and gets all the team members working together. And that's really the key to it, is understanding how everybody works and then understanding just how quickly deterioration happens for our patients. And like you said, seeing what happens with patients beyond our own shift. And I'll give you one example of that. It was how I came to understand post-intensive care syndrome, was from working with a patient in an outpatient clinic. They were coming to me because they had fallen and they'd hurt their back. But as I questioned them more about the situation and how they ended up falling, they had gotten lost. They were a 45-year-old woman who couldn't remember where she lived on her street, and she couldn't remember which house was hers. When she got out of her car, she said, "Margaret, I've driven to this house. I've lived here for 15 years. I can't remember how to navigate my car." And I dug into that a little bit more, and it was post-intensive care syndrome. And at that point, I had no idea what it was. And I dug into that more, and it just horrified me that these problems were unseen. We can see hip problems, we can see a limp, we can see somebody who can't transfer, but the cognition and these problems that our patients are leaving our facilities with, we don't realize it. That was one of the big things that hit me, that we have to do something about this.
Yeah, I think you're, you know, exactly right that we don't get that feedback, especially in the critical care setting. We're not getting feedback about what our patients' lives are like when they leave the hospital. I don't think most nurses are aware of the fact that a 40-year-old can have such cognitive decline so quickly. Otherwise, I think it would be, you know, higher up on our priority of patient interventions for the day, but we just don't have that perspective. And again, I think nurses often think of mobility as not necessarily a priority for us, or not our job. But why should we as nurses make it a priority in our nursing care to get our patients up and moving?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of nurses don't realize that even just a couple of days in bed can have significant physiological impact that affects not just their functional outcome that therapists are working on, can they transfer in and out of a chair, etc., but there's a lot of nursing metrics that mobility impacts and immobility adversely impacts. And let me just give you a few of those things that happen within the first 24 hours of immobility.
Great.
We start to get joint contractures. So this happens in all of us. You and I, if we're young and mobile and we're normally very healthy, we'll get a little bit of tightening in our joints. And sometimes we feel this even in a car ride. Right?
Mm-hmm.
We sometimes get out of a car and we're a little bit stiff, and we stretch out and we move again and we're fine. We compensate and we recover from that very quickly. But think about somebody whose tissues aren't as pliable, our elderly population. For them, that stiffness that happens within a day of being in bed can be the difference for them literally being able to get out of bed and not being able to get out of bed. Many of the patients are complaining of back pain and joint stiffness within not even 24 hours sometimes. So for somebody who doesn't have that same margin of rebound, that joint contracture can make a big difference for them. Another example is insulin resistance, right? We know that our glucose metabolism is a constant factor that we're watching, because we know that hyperglycemia is very harmful to our patients. If they do have a wound, we know that hyperglycemia will retard wound healing. High blood sugar is a problem for a lot of our patients. If they're diabetic, obviously it's an even bigger problem. And so when we think about nursing metrics, the biggest user of glucose is our muscles. If we're not using our muscles, that glucose remains in our bloodstream and it's harder for the body to get rid of it. So the insulin resistance is tied to the amount of glucose in our system. And in fact, a study that was done in Chicago by the author is John Kress. It's an older study now. I think it was in like 2009 or 2010. He and his team at Rush University in Chicago, they looked at exogenous insulin administration, and they found that the patients that mobilized required less than one-third of the exogenous insulin to keep those euglycemic index levels as patients who did not mobilize.
Wow. And
that study, their recommendation was that mobility wasn't just about restoring or retaining function. It was also about metabolic homeostasis in our patients.
Wow.
And that's part of the education that's needed, right? It's not just for nursing and therapy, but our physicians have a role to play as well in helping understand the connection between immobility and some of these hormonal, endocrine, even cardiac outcomes, skeletal muscle outcomes, baroreceptor changes. We know that as human beings, we're dynamic. Our homeostasis and our regulatory systems need those stimuli for normal responses. And when we eliminate or remove the stimulus for that homeostatic regulation, then we get these deleterious effects. And if physicians were to understand that and help their patients understand that mobility is part of their recovery, that would make a big difference too. And that's part of our training for our interdisciplinary teams, is to get the physicians on board and promoting mobility as part of the program.
Yeah. In my practice, I'm seeing that cardiologists, pulmonologists, and surgeons are really the ones who are advocating for mobility for our patients, who are putting in, you know, as part of their orders to get patient up with meals, to mobilize in the hall X number of times per day, and the ones who are kind of holding our feet to the fire to make sure it happens. And I think there are some very obvious benefits to mobilizing for, you know, cardiac and pulmonary reasons, but it's so interesting to hear from you that it goes beyond those two kind of more obvious body systems to endocrinology and even neurology. You know, I'd love for you to share about, you know, the vestibular system and how if we stay in a horizontal position that we're not training our body to be able to handle being in a vertical upright position.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to just touch on the cardiac and pulmonary just briefly. Our muscular system includes our cardiac muscle and our muscles of inspiration and expiration. So when we don't use those muscles, when we're immobile, we lose up to 3% muscle mass per day and muscle function per day of immobility. For you and I, we've got a bit of a cushion there where we can lose probably 10, 15%, and we're still going to be able to function. But so many of our patients are functioning just above, they're teetering above that level where a 3%, a 6% decline for them can be the difference between being able to do what they did before and being going to a nursing home. And so cardiac muscle is the same. And I read a statistic that resting heart rate increases one beat per minute for every 2 days of rest, which may not seem that much, but it makes a difference because it's going to result in shorter diastolic filling time. It's going to result in lower ejection fractions. It's going to result in a lower ability to meet an oxygen delivery demand when we ask that patient to do something. So what could that mean is when we go to the bathroom, where it might be a little bit of a walk, they're going to fatigue quicker. So again, it's not just that the cardiac rate might change, the ability to function when we ask them to do things can change. And the same with pulmonary. You know, we think about respiratory rate, we think about work of breathing, and the respiratory therapists are very cued into this. But if every member of the team is really understanding this, by just standing the patient up, if you think about your diaphragm, right, and think about the patients that you have, even sitting up, even if you raise the head of the bed to 45 degrees, 30 degrees, that's going to improve pulmonary function. However, the intestinal contents are still pushing up against your diaphragm in that sitting position. And even sitting at the edge of the bed, if your patient is going to sit really nice and tall at the edge of the bed, that might help. But so often of our patients at the edge of the bed are kind of slouched, kind of in a slumped position, and you can feel it in your own abdomen that your abdominal contents, if you try and take a deep breath, it's really hard. When you stand, your diaphragm actually drops with the weight of gravity. And you don't have to fight against the weight of your thorax on the bed. So somebody who's at 30 degree head of bed elevation, they're still leaning on their ribcage on the back of the bed. So any expansion of their lungs is still fighting against their upper body weight against gravity, right? So, and that part of the lung that's against the bed and the ribcage is going to have to push against that weight to expand. When you stand, not only does the diaphragm drop down, but now gravity helps you because your upper body, your ribcage is no longer constrained by any surface. So you have the least impedance to expansion of your ribcage for maximum alveolar recruitment. So again, it's not just RT, you know, nurses, doctors, physical therapists, occupational therapists. Each time we have a patient stand up, we're getting the respiratory improvement and benefit for the patient. Each time we have them do it by themselves, we're working those muscles and we're retaining that strength. So it's an activity that when it's done frequently throughout the day by each care discipline, it's not all on nurses to do it. But when the doctor comes in, have the patient stand to listen to the patient's lungs. The respiratory therapist comes in, have them stand up to deliver the medication. When the physical and the occupational therapist come in, they're usually standing the patients up anyway. So that, you know, but if they're not, if the patient is weak, use a device, a lift to stand them up, because we understand that the standing in itself is beneficial.
Especially in our obese population, that's when you're going to get a lot of benefit of getting the patient to stand up to offload, you know, what's pushing back up on the diaphragm from the abdominal girth.
Absolutely. Many of our patients who are larger, they cannot tolerate supine or a small slope in the head of bed. They have to be upright. Many of them don't even sleep supine because they can't breathe. You'd mentioned also the neurological system. And this one, I think, is an area that so many people overlook. And you mentioned the inner ear. I used to work, one of my jobs in the outpatient clinic was complex vestibular disorders. And so I would get referrals from a lot of the doctors where the patients were falling or they were dizzy and they'd ruled out any cardiac issues. And many times what I would find is it's a vestibular hypofunction. So the inner ear and our balance comes from our vision. When we move our heads, our eyes see things, but our inner ear, our vestibular system, is what allows us to stabilize our gaze while our head or our bodies are moving, right? If our inner ear wasn't working, when we move our head, we get dizzy, we get that motion sickness, we get that, oh, I need to sit down kind of a feeling. Our vestibular system, its job is to tell us, are we upright or are we leaning left? Are we leaning right a little bit? Are we stable? If our inner ear is not working, we can be wibble wobbling and we don't get a response from our muscles to correct it until we've gone too far. And then the last thing it does is it tells us whether we're moving forward or moving backwards. So position in space, eye stability, and whether we're moving. When we are immobile, the vestibular system is not getting any input. So its responses, just like our baroreceptors in our blood vessels, when we're not getting a stimulus, the response reaction time decreases. The recruitment and the speed of recruitment of those nerve endings, it's move it or lose it, just like our muscles. So when we're not using it or not moving it, we get more sluggish responses. And so this is one of the areas that immobility can actually increase fall risk. It can increase those balance problems. It can increase visual issues. Sometimes the dizziness our patients get when they get up is not orthostatic hypotension. Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's a vestibular dysfunction that I can't quite get my bearings. And it's because we have not, we've allowed that system to get weaker. And this is particularly true in ICU when we've been immobile and in a coma or in a deep, you know, when I say deep sedation, I think of anything, a RAS -3 or lower. If we can't get a response from that patient, their brain is hypofunctioning and all of the neurological synapses are hypofunctioning.
It's interesting. The more I learn about immobility and the, you know, physiology of it, the more I'm realizing that it's really not necessarily orthostatic hypotension that's causing falls, near misses, but kind of more subtle issues like vestibular hypofunction and the fact that our baroreceptors are not utilized as well when we're laying supine, so that our bodies are not used to mounting that at functional response when we do go vertical.
Right. And it's not just our venous return systems, our lymphatic return systems are impacted, right? So we need to have that rapid fluid return for a normal stroke volume, for a normal ejection fraction. And so if that's sluggish, even if it's a little bit sluggish, that can result in a transient moment. Sometimes that's all it takes for our patients to be diaphoretic on the floor, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, then we're like, oh my gosh, what happened? And so, like you said, it's very often not only one thing, but it's a accumulation of a little bit of orthostatic hypotension. It's a little bit of vestibular. It's a little bit of sensory deficit, muscular weakness. It's all of the body's systems that work together, and we can make a huge difference to so many, not just therapeutic outcomes, functional outcomes, but nursing outcomes on a daily basis by just keeping our patients able to move and keeping changing position with vestibular and with so many of these systems. It's not the amount of time we spend in the new position. It's the number of times we change position, because the change is what creates the stimulus, whether it's a redistribution of fluid, whether it's our vestibular system that changes position. It's not how long did I spend in the chair. It's how many times did I go from supine to sitting to standing to sitting to supine.
That is such a great point. I'm writing it down. I love it. I think we sometimes brag, oh, our patient sat up in a chair for 3 hours today. And while that is good, I think you bring up the good point. Well, that's not necessarily the metric we should use so much as how many times did the patient change their position.
And it doesn't have to be walking five times around the hall. It can be frequent small movement. In fact, there was a study by, there's a couple of authors, Dunstan and Petty are some of the authors that are really doing a lot of research on insulin resistance, lipid profiles, and frequency of activity. And they've done a lot on sedentary office workers. And they have found, they did a study that looked at half of the office went to the gym and did a 1 hour cardiac workout in the morning. And then they sat at their desks the rest of the day. And then the second group did not work out at the gym, but they set their timer for 1 hour and 40 minutes, I think. I don't know, don't ask me how they came up with that metric. But every 1 hour and 40 minutes, they would get up for a couple of minutes and they'd walk around the office. They wouldn't run. They would just walk at a moderate pace and then they'd sit back down at their desk again. The group who did not work out at the gym had much better postprandial glucose levels, had much better insulin resistance, had better lipid profiles than the people that worked out in the gym and then sat the rest of the day. So the people at the gym might have gotten better able to run a marathon by the end of it, but it was better for them to do little amounts frequently throughout the day. And that, I think, is speaks to that first thing we talked about with insulin resistance and lipid profiles.
I love that. Thank you for explaining that, because I wear an Apple Watch and I get frustrated at the nudges I get to stand up.
Yep, they know the research and that's why you get that nudge.
You know, one thing that we've kind of touched on a few times already is this kind of topic of falls. This is a big metric for nurse quality is falls. And I know a lot of nurses are afraid of getting their patients up for fear of falls. But at the same time, we're now understanding through this discussion that not getting up puts your patient at risk for falls. So how can we manage fall risk with immobility?
Absolutely. And so you nailed the first part of it, Annie, where you said that we're now understanding that not getting our patients up is actually increasing their risk of falls. And if we look at the various fall tools that are out there, fall risk tools, you've got the Hendricks, you've got the Johns Hopkins, you've got the Steady. There's a lot of fall risk tools. All of them have altered mental status as a risk factor. They all have altered gait and imbalance or use of an assistive device as a fall risk factor. And keeping a patient in bed slows their cognitive reaction time. It slows their ability to react to different stimuli. So it actually reduces their balance. It reduces the vestibular function, which the primary role of vestibular is to keep us balanced. When we don't move it or stimulate it, we actually increase the risk, and it reduces our skeletal muscle strength. So all of those things are going to make us more likely to fall when we do get up. So we're kind of kicking the can down the road to the next shift, the next care setting. If we're in ICU, we don't see it, right? Because as long as they get through the shift and everything looks good in their vital signs and their ABGs are good and their stats are good and their labs are coming back fine and nobody fell and nobody got hurt, it was a good shift, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then those patients are often falling downstream. They're having these problems downstream in acute med surge, in skilled nursing, in long-term care at the home, because they have suffered from some of these effects. How do we manage this? Because it is a fear and it's a real legitimate fear. We don't want any of our patients to fall. And if they've been immobile for any length of time, there is a risk of falling. This is where your safe patient handling tools are an absolute godsend, because you've got walking harnesses. You mentioned a couple in some of the conversations that we have had in the past about, say, a Steady or a Quick Move or a Van Move or a there's lots of different versions. Most of the manufacturers have this version. And it's a little pool to stand that's got a block in the knees and a little seat that the patient can sit on if they get weak, if their knees buckle. Some of them have removable foot plates that you can actually walk a patient with. And if they do get weak or their knees buckle, they just sit down on it. So it's kind of like a heavy duty walker that's got a seat behind the patient's bottom that they can sit down. They don't have to turn around and sit down on the seat. Walking slings are hugely underutilized. I see so many hospitals that have ceiling lifts, but they don't have any straps. It's basically a girth that goes around the patient's waist with straps that go through the legs. There's lots of different versions of them on the market. And they're hooked up to a sling or a hanger bar or a lift overhead. It can be either in the ceiling or you have floor-based lifts that will go anywhere in the hospital. And you have them walk in one of those. It takes a few minutes to hook it up. It does take some time to learn it. But then it's like anything else. You have to learn it. But then once you know the equipment, it doesn't take that much longer to get them up. And by getting them up in a device or getting them up before the weakness occurs, we can prevent the fall. Getting them up before the weakness occurs is the best way. That's the best way, is keep them functional, prevent the deconditioning and prevent the decline in the first place. Some patients are going to come in and they're already at that level and you can't prevent it because they already fell at home or they had a stroke or they had a new hip or a new knee or something happened that their fall risk inherently increased. And it wasn't a hospital acquired deconditioning that caused it or contributed to it. So in those cases, use the equipment to get them up. And by all means, you're not on your own. You are working with therapy to help you. But the big opportunity is preventing the decline in the first place. One of the things we say a lot is a patient who is not allowed to get out of bed will very quickly become a patient who cannot get out of bed or who is at high risk for falling when they get out of bed.
Yes. Yes. I love that.
Yeah, one of the things that we, or a couple of things that we teach in our consulting is, one is on admission, is this person at their baseline? Right. So one of the things that we find is not frequently asked, and it's an educational point with the admitting physician or the admitting nurse, is to find out, what can you normally do at home? Right. That's our baseline.
That's such an important question.
It is. Because that gives us a framework to work around. What is this person normally able to do? If they're bedbound at home, I'm not going to try and get them up here. But if they had a heart attack on the golf course and they were playing 9 holes of golf and that's what they were doing 3 hours ago, that gives me a baseline that says this is somebody who's really independent, even if they're 85 years old. So that's the first question. And then the second piece of it is, are they at baseline now? Because if they're at baseline now, and we teach people how to do a mobility screen, it's a very quick egress test that goes through a few brief steps to say, how well can this person move and which movements do they need help with? Where are they at risk? It's a very quick screen that everybody is now speaking the same mobility language. They're not, well, assist of one, assist of two. Well, they got a little bit dizzy with me and they got, you know, it gives people a language and it's beyond the scope of what we've got to talk about today. I know we could talk about this for hours, but everybody's on the same page then. And then if they're at their baseline, then it's nurse's job to maintain baseline. If they're not at baseline, or if there's any specific risk factors that make it complicated to get that person up and walking, then that's an appropriate therapy referral. What we quite often find is, I don't have time to walk them, let's order therapy. Those are the areas where we want to really empower you as nurses to realize that you don't need a therapist for so many of these patients. A lot of them will appreciate getting up and walking. The other thing that we talk a lot about is changing the thought process and thinking differently about mobility and falls, in that If a patient is at high risk for falls, you prioritize mobility as an intervention. Rather than saying they're high risk for falls, let's keep them in bed and put the bed alarm on, which I know a lot of nurses hate. A lot of patients hate it. The research doesn't support it, but we keep doing it.
We keep doing it.
Keep doing it because we don't know what else to do, right? I mean, if you think about all of the fall prevention interventions, we keep rearranging them in a different order and think that we're going to get different results. I have patients who say, you know, red slippers, yellow slippers, and I'll go in, where are your slippers? And the patient said to me one time, oh, the slippers of shame.
Oh,
I've got my red slippers because I'm a bad patient. And this is what they feel, right? This is a really hard part of, we're trying to manage risk, but our patients feel like they've been a bad patient. And so if that patient is high risk for falls, get your lift, get therapy involved as well, and get them up. Prioritize mobility for those patients, but do it with the right equipment so that if their knees do buckle, if they do get dizzy, they're not hitting the floor. They're sitting in the lift and they're in the harness and they're safe.
Before we jumped on this interview, I said to Margaret how much I love using the Sarah study. For me, it's one that I can use usually independently with a patient. I don't have to wait for another assistant to come help with it. And it's a way for me to mobilize my patients when physical therapy isn't there. Also, overhead lifts. I recently started at a new hospital and every room has an overhead lift. And I don't see nurses using them at all. And I think they're probably maybe weren't trained on it, or their training was a long time ago and they just feel generally unfamiliar with it. And they think, oh, it's going to be this big coordinated effort to use the overhead lift. But I've used it so much in past facilities that it's so easy for me to just grab the overhead lift, grab the remote, hook on, you know, the straps and get a patient turned or up in bed without hurting our backs. And I'd love for you to share any other, you know, ways that we could kind of build mobility into our the reality of having very busy schedules as a nurse.
Absolutely. And the examples you brought up are prime examples, because the other thing we hear a lot is, I don't have time.
Yeah.
Especially as we are dealing with shortages, not just nursing, but we don't have enough therapists. We don't have enough physicians. We don't have enough access to care is a huge deal. And time to get all these things done is really a big problem. You mentioned that you've had time to get to know your equipment. And once you know it, it's so much faster to use the lift than to go and get even another person. There was a study that came out in the Journal of Safe Patient Handling and Mobility several years ago. The author's name is Patty Mechan, M-E-C-H-A-N. And she's a physical therapist that works for an equipment company. But she did a time study on how long it takes to find a second person or sometimes a third person.
I love it.
Right? Versus how long it takes once you know it. Once you know and you've developed your skill set to put a sling under a patient, or many facilities now, you mentioned a facility where there's 100% ceiling coverage. That's the gold standard that hospitals, that is the ANA recommendation, the gold standard moving forward. Not all hospitals are there yet, but making beds up with the repositioning sling as the sheet, so that you've already got it in place. A lot of the companies have done a lot of really good work. And I don't sell any of the equipment, but I love to promote the companies that have done a good job on this, because they've put the work in. They've done the work to get moisture wicking materials so that these repositioning slings can stay under the patient, and they're approved by wound care, and the friction shear, all of those metrics are in line with what they need to be. But then it's right there. You just hook it up. If you need to reposition, boost, turn. The caveat for that is we want to involve the patient and make sure that we're not doing for the patient passively what the patient could be doing for themselves. And that's where that safe, early, continuous mobility piece comes in, rather than just passive mobility with a lift. We want to be sure that we're training people to know how to use the lifts to promote mobility, not just to move passively. So again, that's the caveat to using the lift. And it's all part of just developing the skill set. Along the lines of the skill set that I hear is managing patients, especially for the mobility side of it, even before we talk about equipment, is in ICU, waking patients up and getting them out of bed and getting them up and walking is a very intimidating thing for a lot of nurses. And I hear all the time, we don't have time. What do you mean get them up? They're on a vent, right? Let's wait till they're extubated and then let's get therapy in and then we'll start mobility. But all those effects that we saw are then multiplied when we add delirium and agitation and acute brain dysfunction or encephalopathy, as it's been termed with CMS, that, you know, a lot of the benzos that we're using are myotoxic. They actually destroy the neuromuscular junction. So all the things we talked about with muscle weakness get even worse with the propofol and with some of the benzos that we're administrating. And it was actually a nurse friend. Some of you may know her. Some of your followers may know her, Kaylee Dayton. She does a podcast, Walking Home from the ICU. And she was sharing me, I give this credit to her because she has talked with so many nurses that she said, you know, when we've got sedated patients and we're fearful of getting them up because it's going to take too much time, we're already doing a lot. You are busy. You're doing so many things for that patient. You're running at least two sedatives. Depending on the rate, sometimes you're switching bags out pretty frequently. You're double checking with another nurse because a lot of them are class one drugs that you're administering. You're having to waste those drugs. You're sometimes hanging another vasopressor to counteract the effect of the first set of medicines that you have administered, right? And then compensating for the sedation. You've then got a patient who's comatose who needs Q2R turning, or they're developing pressure injuries, or now you're treating a sacral or a heel wound that is all adding to your day. You're charting restraints, you're looking at orders, you're doing all these things. And now you're dealing with emergent delirium and agitation. And that's a lot of work to care for that patient. And the challenge is that that's become accepted practice. So you don't think of it as a lot of work because you just accept it because that's what you do. But what if by mobilizing your patients and getting them up right after intubation, like not sedating them in the first place or doing minimal sedation so that they're at a RASS of truly zero, negative one, maybe a negative two, but avoiding those deeper RASS scores of negative three, negative four, negative five, what if you could get that patient up and avoid all of those things? How much time would it save you?
Oh my gosh. A lot of time. And I think you're emphasizing correctly the early part of it before the patient is going down this fast track to deconditioning, to delirium. I think that is such a crucial time right after, you know, intubation at the beginning of an ICU stay. How are we going to mobilize this patient?
And how are we going to avoid deep sedation so they can mobilize?
Yes, exactly. Oh, yes. I know we're focusing mostly here on the physiology of immobility, but we could also, for a different episode, talk about the pharmacology involved in immobility and how sedatives and paralytics really play heavily into immobility as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that we just have this false economy of time. A lot of it is just fearing something different. It's different, right? Thinking differently. We get comfortable in our routines. But what I would hope, if anybody can take anything from this podcast, is mobility is a win-win for everybody. It helps save us time and reduce the burden of nursing care. And I'll give you another example, I think, that would be helpful, not in an ICU, but in acute care, is toileting a patient. And I've seen this many times. I had one nurse who had spoken to me specifically about this. She said, you know, Margaret, when we were talking about time, she said, I had a patient that needed to go to the bathroom. They took a little bit of help to get up. They were probably modestest of two, one to two people, depending on their moment, right? She needed to go to the bathroom. I didn't have time to go and get the commode. And in my head, it was faster to use a bedpan. So grab the bedpan. It's in the bottom drawer. It's right beside her bed. I had to roll the patient to the side. She was probably about 260, 265 pounds. So she wasn't a light lady. I didn't think to ask her, can you roll yourself? Right? So often we don't think to ask the patient. We just do. So I'm pushing her over on her side. I'm holding her with one hand. I'm getting the bedpan in with the other hand. I'm bringing her back onto it. She's wincing in pain because I don't know if you've ever lain on a bedpan. It's not very comfortable, or even tried to go and void on a bedpan. It's really not a pleasant experience. But she had been in a rush. The patient had voided somewhat. She ended up soiling the bed, you know, because she went to take the bedpan out and it tipped slightly on its side, as it so often does. And now she's got a wet spot under the bed. She's like, gosh darn it, now I have to change the sheets. So now I've got to do another task. And by the time she was done, she said, Margaret, I could have put that patient on the commode three times for the time it now took me to do all these extra things. And I've got a patient who's not very happy because it was uncomfortable and it hurt my arm to reach, you know. So we are in such a hurry sometimes that we just don't think about, is there a better way to do this? And preserving a patient's ability to do for themselves and promoting that and really thinking about the things that we are doing, which are creating this hospital-acquired deconditioning and all the physiology that we've talked about, the thought of doing something different can be really hard. But if we can invest in that change, and that's what we do as consultants, as we come alongside people and say, listen, we know it's hard. We know that you're busy. We know that your bandwidth for thinking outside of your shift is somewhat limited or very limited. So let us come alongside you. And we have PTs, OTs, nurses, physician, respiratory. We've got consultants across the spectrum that can just help to nudge along and help with the training and help in mentoring in on the units to say, let us come alongside in the care practice. It's hard, but it's worth it. Because the patients at the end of the day, they go home sooner. They go home rather than skilled nursing or post-acute, you know, about 30% more patients will go home when they've been mobilized compared to discharge to skilled nursing or subacute rehab. The conference that you're going to come to in Orlando, our movement at this conference, somebody summed it up last year at the end of the conference. They said, this isn't a conference, it's a movement.
Mm-hmm.
We start the conference out with a boulder. And if you can imagine this massive boulder, and this boulder represents the status quo. The inertia to move this boulder is the inertia to change the status quo. And so when everybody is doing a little bit here and a little bit there, the picture, the vision that we have is I take my shoulder with as much force as I've got and I run
all
up
right.
and I
Until
shove
next time,
the boulder and I try and move it on my
own. Nursing game.
And then somebody else does it from a different angle at a different time and runs and shoves into the boulder. When we all do it at different times and different directions, the boulder doesn't move. Our goal is to all get on the same side of the boulder and all push together. The vendors, the clinicians, the nurses, the doctors, the therapists, the consultants, if we all push together, we can change this. But we're doing it together rather than each person trying to fight against the culture in their own facility. And so that's really what our conference is all about, is taking these principles and helping people connect with others who've been successful and work together to create the change, because it's worth the fight.
Culture is so hard to change. It's so, so hard to change. And I love that visual of a boulder. It is that difficult. It is that stubborn.
It's usual care. It's hard, right? I mean, we do, like you said, we do a lot of things that are not actually evidence-based, but we do them because they're normal practice. Bed alarms, bed exit alarms. We talked about those, right? It's an exciting time because the momentum is building.
Where could listeners find you, Margaret, your company and what you're doing? And if listeners want to learn more.
If you go to earlymobility.com, you'll see our website, all the information for the conferences on there. We've got a lot of the information like that day-by-day calendar that we talked about, the impact of one day of immobility. You can see by each day, and that's something you can download right from the website. There's some tools on there. And my email is margaret@earlymobility.com. It's pretty easy. So if anybody does have questions, please feel free to reach out to me. We would love, as a consulting team, you know, if you need some help, if you want some, just a Q&A, we're going to be starting actually after the conference, a monthly live panel for our customers who are working with us to jump on and say, hey, even if you worked with us 5 years ago, we've got questions about this and this and this, you know, and have kind of some free consulting once a month. So we've got some fun things in the works here, but yeah, we get the struggle. We understand the struggle, and we are here to help, even if it's just some questions that you have. And I would love to see as many people as possible coming and helping us move that boulder. If you've got listeners that are, you know, if you're listening today and you're like, you know what, I think I could help. Maybe you've had a success and you can come and share it with us, how you got there, share it with other clinicians. Here's how we overcome that problem, and here's how we got around that barrier. That's what people are just so hungry for, is the research is great. We know it's important. We know it's good. But how do we make this happen in our facilities? And how do we change the culture? So this is the place to come to and network with others. And the more people that come, the more people that are pushing the boulder together, the faster we'll move it.
Well, I hope this episode serves as an extra shoulder pushing against that boulder.
That would be amazing. Yeah. And
thank you.
Better for everybody.
Thank you for taking the time today, Margaret. This has been a great discussion.
Thank you so much for having me on here.
If you want to dig deeper into the impacts of immobility, be sure to check out the show notes of this episode. I've added a link to Margaret's comprehensive document, The Effects of Immobility, which was actually the catalyst for this episode. You'll also find information about the Early Mobility Conference, which is happening this April 2024. I will be going and would love to connect with you there. This conference is a fantastic opportunity to learn about cutting-edge strategies to get our patients up and moving. So I hope to see you there in April, as we continue this crucial conversation on ending harmful immobilization. All right, that's all for today. I hope that you have upped your nursing game.